Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central podcast for Friday, April 5th, 2019. My name is Daniel Bader, and this week I'm joined by Jerry Hildenbrand. Welcome back.
Hey, nice to be back.
So you're here not just because you have the loveliest voice on the radio, but because we are going to dig into some seriously nerdy stuff, and I'm really excited. So if you have your pocket square, your pocket protector, and your pen, get ready because it's going to be fun. And Andrew Martinick, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
How are you doing?
No pocket protectors here. I do not have a shirt pocket today.
But are you high on LaCroix? That's what I want to know.
Yes, absolutely. Lime, currently.
Mm. That's not the good flavor. What is happening?
It's all I have available at the moment.
Oh, no.
I've been out of town. I come back. We're really in the back of the refrigerator right now.
It's yeah, like a no hipster kidding. Avalanche. You all in that LaCroix. I just drink water.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, LaCroix is technically water.
But it's fancy.
There
water.
Is water in it somewhere.
But it's better and more expensive.
That's true. Oh, my God. All right. So we'll dig into some 5G stuff later on. We're also going to talk about Android Q Beta 2, which is kind of a disaster. And if you're interested in learning about what Android
all
Q...
out.
Well, it is. I mean, right now it's a beta, so we'll talk about why that is. But first, we're going to start with another sort of disaster, and that would be the Nokia 9 PureView. The last week's show, we talked a lot about the Huawei P30 and P30 Pro and the camera, and just how advanced and awesome Huawei is in the camera department. Very versatile, and the definition of versatility is that, you know, you have this one thing, this one product that you can do a lot with. And with a phone like the P30 Pro, you have, you know, wide angle 0.6x all the way up to 10x lossless or hybrid lossless, whatever you want to call it. It's pretty usable across the focal length. On the other side of it, on the other side of the conversation, we have the Nokia 9 PureView, which is versatile in a very different way. It has five camera sensors on the back, and they all work in tandem to provide a lot of detail, excellent low light, and dynamic depth, so up to 1,200 depth points. And they worked with the company Lite to achieve that, along with Qualcomm. Lots of really interesting technology here, but the result was, in my opinion, quite disappointing. And it's not because the tech is bad, but because the implementation of the tech is bad.
And that's so, the hard part. Like, the actually making the most of all of that information that you get in is what's so hard. It's like the capture is not the difficult part anymore.
No, it's not. And it speaks to the fact that you think cameras are easy, and then you see something like this where there's so much more information that's being brought into the phone, say, than a Pixel 3, which just uses a single sensor and a single lens, and that achieves way better results in most situations. So, Jerry, let's talk a little bit about this, because I sent you some of the photos that I took really, like, well before I wrote the review, just kind of getting a sense for this camera, being like, why are the JPEGs coming out of this camera so underwhelming? And, you know, what you said to me was they're just poorly processed, that ultimately it comes down to they're over-sharpened and the color science is wrong, and they just don't look like the real world.
Yeah, it's when you look at the raw photos, you can see there's a lot of information there, and it just doesn't look like they're using it as well as they could be.
So give us the 30-second explanation for what happens when a phone takes in that information through a sensor or multiple sensors, and it works with the image signal processor in the SoC to process it into a JPEG. Like, what is what's happening through that pipeline?
Well, one of the first things it does is try to find what white is, and that's, you know, your white balance and your source of light and the color of your light makes that a little trickier than it sounds, because it needs to know what's white and what's gray and what's yellow, and there's a difference between the three. So it sets the white balance, which decides, you know, where the colors are going to start. It'll then try to tune in the colors to be a little more pleasing and a little, maybe slightly not real, but make them look a little bit better for us. And then it has to find the edges of everything and get the right amount of sharpening so it looks good to our eyes without looking weird. Yeah, that's the best way I can describe it, is it looks weird if you over sharpen along the edge of something. It looks like you've used Photoshop to paste like a tree into a field if you over process the edges. Then it has to, it has to smooth everything out, and it has to try to deal with the electrical noise that the pixels generate. That would try to make things be red that aren't really red. And it has to know all this and use the information that the sensors captured along with the programming in it to turn all these individual points of light into something that we not only recognize, but we like to see. And it's a matter of detecting the edges, smoothing and sharpening in the right amounts, and setting the color profile and then tweaking the colors.
And so, Jerry, is this, that's obviously all extremely complicated, but that's what every phone and camera does.
Every electronic camera does that. Film cameras actually do the same thing, but a little bit differently.
And it's obviously, there are so many variables at play there that can all be tweaked to do things slightly differently. And that's why we see photos come out so dramatically differently between cameras and phones. But do you think that it has to have gotten much more complicated when you're talking about multiple sensors, between color sensors and monochrome sensors? You have to think that the additional amount of data that this has to process all at once made it a lot harder to dial those things in just right, compared to, like Daniel said, when you're just dealing with, like on the Pixel, a single sensor, single lens, you put all of your might behind that, it's a much smaller data set to work with than four or five sensors all at the same time.
Well, and an important thing to remember is, let's say the three of us get together and build a phone. If we just slap a camera sensor on the back and, you know, use a high quality sensor and depend on Qualcomm, Qualcomm to process our images, they're going to turn out pretty good. As long as the sensor is good and the aperture of the electronic lens we're using is good, the pictures will turn out okay. Companies like Samsung and Google might do a little extra to make the pictures better. But when you add four other cameras, you can no longer depend on Qualcomm. And Nokia had to engineer a lot of this or pay Qualcomm to help them do it. And it got super tricky.
And I think about the other part of that as well, is that you mentioned having the right aperture there. And that reminded me that there's also all of the before you capture parts of the software where, you know, again, when you're dealing with one sensor, it's a little bit easier for the sensor to read things live, have the processor and ISP recognize what to set the ISO, aperture, et cetera, and set all these parameters before it captures. And again, much more difficult when you're talking about multiple sensors all at once and you have to adjust them all together. It just seems like an insane engineering problem, and it's not surprising to me that Nokia wasn't able to do it.
Right. Especially if you look at the back of this phone, the camera lenses are so far apart, I'm surprised it can take a picture of anything closer than 3 feet. Just to get the focus and the aperture settings correct when your lenses are a good 10, 15 centimeters apart. It's just, they did a good job to at least make it even work.
what's really interesting about this setup is that every single photo taken on the Nokia 9 uses all five sensors. And as you said, there are three monochrome and two RGB sensors. And the idea here is that the monochrome sensors, because they don't have to process color, they are able to take in more light just by virtue of their, they don't have those color filters on them. And together, every single photo has 60 megapixels worth of information. They also have a lot of depth information. And while the final result, the JPEG, is not, it's not massive, it's not a huge, it's not a large file, because they do all the processing in the back end and spit out what they believe to be the right finished product. When you turn it on, and I believe you should, you can also take a raw file, a raw capture with every single photo. And that is saved as a lossless DNG, which is usually around 40 megabytes each. And what I did for my review, which I thought was going to be the most helpful for people to understand the differences, was to take the raw files and lightly edit them in Lightroom Mobile, and then spit them out as a JPEG to show what I believe the final product should be straight out of the camera, right? That you have this potential for really, really attractive, beautiful JPEGs, and the auto mode is just missing the mark. And what people criticized me for that, because they said, you know, first of all, Nokia is delivering what it believes is true to life colors, which it's not, because
just wrong.
It's wrong. And if you look at Mr. Mobile's video review, he calls it, you know, trust the processing. And he says that he likes the fact that the photos that come out of the camera are very true to life. And I disagree with him. I mean, we are colleagues, and I love 99% of what he does, but I just outright disagree with him in that one argument. And that's because people prefer different types of photos. I mean, have told you in this podcast before, I prefer colorful, kind of oversaturated photos. That's just my thing.
But you also put the raw photos in your Google Photos library so I could take a look at them side by side. The JPEGs look very close to the raw, unsharpened, unenhanced photos. It's like Nokia just stopped. They didn't do enough.
I mean, I'll just say one more thing, is that, you know, I prefer the kind of colorful, oversaturated, but I also don't want that for every single photo. And what I will say is that when you spit out a JPEG that has almost no color and is super over-sharpened, you're starting at a severe deficit there. You cannot edit that color back in with the way that you can with a raw file. You can't edit that file. You can't edit the exposure back in the way you can with a raw file. And when I've spoken to Nokia people, the representatives, they said, well, this isn't a phone for the regular photographer. This is a phone for people who want to tweak every photo. And I'm going to argue that that doesn't matter if the JPEGs it spits out using auto mode are completely unusable.
Yeah, that's a massive crutch that I just don't find to be genuine or perhaps even truthful. There's no necessary reason why the fact that you have all of this extra data and to be able to and the ability to spit out the 40 megabyte DNG, there's no reason why that means that your JPEGs have to be terrible. Like, those things can and should be separate.
Nokia is doing some things right. I pulled the review back up because one picture really stands out, the snowy road. If you look at the JPEG that Nokia spit out and look far in the distance, the trees that are at the what appears to be the end of the road, Nokia's JPEG, those trees look sharper and more in focus than what Daniel could get with, I assume, Lightroom on a RAW file. That's because the special depth of information that Nokia is getting from all those cameras probably doesn't translate in, you know, into the RAW metadata, and any photo processor can't handle it, doesn't know what to do with it, but they can do something with it themselves. So that's kind of impressive that they got that. But then the rest of the picture, it's an ugly brown mess, whereas Daniel was able to show us where it's not all ugly and brown. So, you know, they get some of it, but they're not nailing it at all.
So I think the question here, Jerry, is the foundation is here. Can subsequent software updates give the, you know, tweak the processing enough where it can spit out images like the ones that I generated?
Sure.
And if so, what does that say about the way that they approached the accumulation of data? Like, why do the photos look like they do today? Like, what is the reason? Did somebody just mess up and you know, put a toggle in the wrong direction? Or is this the desired output that Nokia engineers actually wanted?
If you would really study the photographs, looking at them on the device itself, do they look any brighter? Do the colors show up more? You know how some displays can bring out color that other displays don't. And I just kind of get the feeling that they fine-tuned everything where they thought it looked really good on the display of the phone, and that's where they stopped. You know, maybe they even knew it wouldn't look as good if you viewed these pictures on another device, but they really tailored them to look good on their, you know, their phone itself, which I guess is the right way to go. I don't know. I mean, we tend to over-criticize for some things, but this is not one of those cases. Nokia has a lot of work to do to live up to the potential this phone has in the camera department.
So I have been told by Nokia reps that there will be a significant software update that will affect the camera output. They are not committing to a timeline. I think the next big update, they just want to get right, as opposed to releasing a bunch of small updates. Sure. That may not fix the problem. Whether it kind of turns the narrative around, it remains to be seen. But I like this phone. I gave it a 3 out of 5, and that was because I wanted to like this phone a lot, and I like elements of it. I think that it is very well designed. It has some amazing assets, like the haptic engine is great. The screen is really nice. The software is clean, and the RAW files that it produces are quite good. I mean, it can produce really nice photos, but every time you take a photo, it takes 10 seconds to process it. Whoa. That just isn't the kind of, that isn't the experience that I want. And in contrast, Andrew, you just did a Galaxy S10 versus Pixel 3 photo comparison. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, this is a much more mainstream comparison where, you know, these are two phones that have minor differences in how they process JPEGs, but ultimately they're both really reliable cameras.
Yeah, the big thing is that they're both extremely consistent, but it does get back to that same discussion of how these companies decide to put their photo processing to work and work with that, you know, in this case, individual sensors at a, you know, one at a time anyway, in the Galaxy S10's case, is, you know, that applies across every single photo, and it comes out in different ways in different kinds of scenes. But these cameras take, within their own lane, extremely consistent shots. They have their own quirks, and you get to know them, but you don't get wildly different output. And especially in the Pixel 3's case, you know really what you're going to get. You're going to get something a little more natural, but not bland, like we were talking about with the Nokia 9. And of course, on the other end of it, Samsung's known for really ramping up the saturation, the clarity and the colors and making everything pop a little bit more. But that's how it is for every single photo that it takes. And people love consistency. They want to know that the floor of their photo quality is pretty high, and they don't necessarily care if that means that the ceiling is a little bit lower. I mean, in the case of the Galaxy S10, you can, of course, also take raw photos, but you're not getting the same amount of data as something like the Nokia 9 is providing you. But the Galaxy S10 is a perfect example of the JPEG processing is pretty darn good. It's not as good as the Pixel 3s, but it's pretty darn good. And a lot of people like the way the camera takes photos. And they offer you the ability to just get the raw photo and edit it how you want it. There's no reason why having raw output and lossless raw output makes your JPEGs bad. You can do both of those things.
Yeah, exactly. You should have... The RAW just gives you more data, especially exposure data, lighting data to work with. You know, you can always recover highlights from a RAW file that you can't from a JPEG. It's the same as it is with a piece of music, right? If you save it as an MP3, you just lose the low and the high end most likely. They just chop off the dynamic range and just make it a fundamentally a smaller range of frequencies.
And if you want to see how that plays out in the real world, the S10 versus the Pixel 3 is a really good comparison because they take very different photos in lots of situations. You know, ostensibly given the same rough parameters, obviously they're in the same scene, but they're both using just a single camera with a single pretty fast lens, and they come out with dramatically different things because they massaged it a little bit differently.
On the other side of it, you know, I mentioned the P30 Pro. I've been using this for a week now, and the criticism I had 2 weeks ago about the Galaxy S10's camera, that it leaves faces really splotchy. There's not a lot of detail there, and it just looks soft on when you take photos of people. I don't have that criticism of the P30 Pro. It's not quite as good as the Pixel 3. I find the Pixel 3 retains a lot more facial detail, but it's such a versatile camera, and it gets close to the amount of facial detail that I'm not going to trade it. I actually think I'm going to keep using the P30 Pro as my daily driver. So watch out for that review next week. When you hear this, probably this week, and stay tuned for that. But I'm really, really impressed with what Huawei's doing. So let's move on and just talk about a couple other pieces of news this week that I think affected a lot of people that listen to this show. There were two Google products that were killed on the same day on April 2nd.
One more important than the other.
The one is Google Plus, which, you know, it was dead for a very long time. So I'm not sure people are going to miss it, except Ara.
A single tear rolls down Vit Gundotra's face somewhere.
Yeah, right. But, you know, our Ara Wagoner wrote a really nice eulogy for Google Plus, which, you know, she actually got her job at Android Central with back in 2012. So, you know, that's something to be said. And I know, Jerry, you use Google Plus quite a lot when it was relatively popular.
Yeah. Yeah. I really liked the platform and the way Google did it. It just wasn't meant to be, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, when it started encroaching on other Google products, then I think people rebelled and just rejected it outright.
And there's just not so much to say at this point, considering that in most people's minds, it had already died.
What I really liked about Google Plus is something that a lot of people didn't like. I liked the fact that you couldn't be anonymous at first. I've had some issues with, you know, if you're anonymous on the internet, some people think that means you can do or say anything. And on Google Plus, you couldn't do that and be anonymous while you were doing it. I like that aspect. I understand some people need to stay anonymous because, you know, maybe what they're saying can't be associated with them or they'll put themselves in danger. And I really feel for those people. But I like the fact that your name was behind the things you said.
And yeah, that full name policy thing didn't get removed, but it got kind of
watered down.
And then Facebook adopted its own version of that later on. But yeah, I mean, Google Plus was kind of a dumpster fire in so many ways that I don't think people are going to miss it. What people are really going to miss, though, is Google Inbox, which also died on Tuesday. And I was surprised at the outpouring of sadness and just like resentment towards Google when this died, because there are some people who love Inbox who just hate Gmail. And that's something I just can't really parse. Like, they're so similar in my opinion that I just don't get it. But, you know, maybe you do. If you listen and you love Inbox, tell us why. Podcast and Android Central. Did either of you use Inbox?
I used it when it first came out. And like you said, I thought that it was... I mean, it was just Gmail with obviously a different kind of interface that lets you manage mail in a different way. I never had an issue and still don't with, you know, massive overruns of my inbox or not being able to manage things. I really get by well with labels and folders and starred and priority inbox, things like that. But so I guess Inbox didn't appeal to me from that perspective. And so I just went back to using Gmail. But I agree. There were a lot of people that were just extremely, not just sad, but angry at Google about it.
But I need something. My email inbox is a mess. I'm up to like 5,000 unread again. And it's because I relied on email as a form of communication so much that I just have everything coming in. And I thought inbox was going to be my savior, but it maybe was a little too strong and I missed way too much that didn't get brought to my attention with inbox, but I do need something. Google, try again.
So here's the thing, right? Google has, or Gmail has smart inbox as well.
Yeah.
Where it just kind of puts what it believes to be the most important emails right in front of you. And then puts the kind of less important things into social or newsletter categories, but it's not quite as, I think, severe of a filter as Inbox had. And I think that people really liked the fact that it did most of that filtering work for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Outlook, Microsoft's Outlook, my personal favorite, Newton, the new Spark Mail, which just debuted on Android. They all have their own versions of like the smart inbox, which tries to filter email for you to get rid of any spam or anything that it doesn't think you need to read right away. But just based on the amount of email that I get, any filter is going to be inherently broken.
Yeah. And I just don't trust it. I'm sure that there is something to be said for that for a lot of people, but I just don't trust it, because as soon as it gets one thing wrong, I'm never going to use it again.
Right. That's true. I mean, when you miss an important email because some algorithm decided that it was spam or the attachment was a potential virus or something, yeah, you just don't want to do that anymore. At the same time, most of these email services like Newton and Spark, and even Outlook, they suck up all your email onto their servers so they can do all the filtering for you.
Yeah.
Whereas Inbox was native to Google, so it didn't have to do that. And I think people preferred that compromise where you've already signed that privacy policy, you know what Google's doing with your data, and Inbox was just a better version of what they were already giving you. But hey, you know, if you like that, then... I think that you might want to try Spark. I've been using it for a few days. It's pretty good. I don't think it's amazing. But if it's free and they don't they don't have like a super severe privacy policy the way that some others do. They certainly do look through your emails, and there's an element of kind of they make their money through teams. Like they have an enterprise service where they will get people to pay, get companies to pay to sort of create like a mini Slack within your email client. You can collaborate on emails while you're drafting them.
I have to say that frankly sounds awful.
Yeah, don't let Kevin find that out, because there's no way.
I've used it in that way a few times, but yeah, it's not great. Unless you have everybody on your team on the same page. If you're already using Slack, it's not very useful. Anyway, try Slack, try Spark, it's free. It's actually, you know, it's available now, so give it a try, see if you like it. Okay, so let's move on. We're going to take a quick break and thank our sponsor for the show, and we will be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Wix. Over 140 million people use Wix for their website, and that's because you can start publishing a website for free. Choose from over 500 stunning templates, or design your own from scratch with customized text, images, video, and more. You can choose hundreds of designs with your own video backgrounds, galleries, menus, forms, lists, and so on. You can even put clip art in if you are addicted to the 90s like I am. If you want to be simple, you can just publish one of their templates for your podcast, for your resume, for anything. That's because Wix is completely customizable and you can get set up in minutes. If you want to design your own, of course, you can do so in HTML. I remember reading a book about HTML3 back when I was like 16 years old. I'm pretty sure I remember some of it, so even I could design my own website using Wix. Of course, if you run your own business, Wix has a full set of business solutions just for you, from e-commerce to music to hotels to events and more. There are APIs if you are a developer, if you want to link it up to other programs, as well as custom JavaScript to control your site's functionality. But as I said, you don't need to know any HTML or CSS to get started. If you want to get started, though, you can go to wix.com/podcast for 10% off a premium version of your website. That's wix.com/podcast to get 10% off. And as always, we thank Wix for their support of the Android Central podcast. Now, back to the show. All right, let's talk Android Q Beta 2. So Jerry, it's been about a month since the first beta was released, and the first beta, now in retrospect, was not really Android Q, obviously.
No.
Because it was so stable, and everything just sort of worked, that I was like, oh my god, this is the best thing ever. I could use this as my daily driver.
Right. They called it a beta, not a dev preview. You're like, this is good.
This is great. It was basically Android Pie with a new font. We know that now. So Beta 2 comes out and it breaks everything. And I mean everything. Like, you can barely use any of the apps because of a new feature called scoped storage, which I want to learn about. It introduces a bunch of notification features, basically like a notification bubble, like Facebook's chat heads, which also breaks a whole bunch of stuff. And there's just like clues as to what they're going to be doing in future versions. But I think the worst thing is that they are revamping the gestures within Android Q in front of our very eyes. They released the beta with a broken gesture system. And if you're running a Pixel 3, you don't have the option of going back to a three button nav system. So Jerry, let's walk through the various features, starting with those gestures, and we'll just run through the rest of them. Why are they revamping the gestures? What was wrong with the ones that debuted on Android
Pie? I don't know. I mean, everybody complained about them, which is, you know, that's not going to move Google's needle just because we complain, but that's certainly going to be factored, you know, into the decision. But apparently they thought they could do better. I'm reaching here because I have no idea why they broke what they had that actually kind of worked and gave us this. I'm lost,
man. It definitely, like, pie gestures definitely didn't feel finished. You're right. They worked as intended, but it just seemed like it still seemed like it wasn't a complete thought because they were, well, part of that was being stuck with the back button still and figuring out how to do that. But it really felt like there was just a few different ideas that weren't all on the same page. And now they're kind of revamping it. I mean, I guess the only worry here, right, the worry here is that they're revamping it in front of our eyes. And, you know, it's always a little panic inducing because, you know, it's actually changing and it hadn't even been solidified yet.
This is beta software and we signed up for this. I want to say that up front. This is my own fault. I hit that button, read the known issues thing, and read about how I shouldn't use it if I need to actually use my phone and clicked OK anyway. But this is bad. This is way worse than any of the betas last time.
I mean, look, this is like, as you said, this is a beta. I'm not worried that this is the finished product. Right. This is certainly not what the gestures are going to look like. Let's actually go through what they are in case you haven't used them. So
I picked my phone up off the Pixel stand and it's restarting.
Right now with the gestures on Android Pie, you have sort of this hybrid system where from the home screen, you swipe up halfway to get to your multitasking menu and then swipe up again to get to the app drawer. You can swipe on the pill to the right to go directly into the multitasking and just hold your thumb to the right to go between apps and then swipe back and forth along that to get through different apps. And there's a really satisfying haptic feedback to, you know, let you know that you're going between your apps. You can enter that multitasking menu from basically anywhere, including the home screen. And, you know, it's a little clunky because you can't just swipe your thumb up and get into the app drawer. It's sort of like a 1.5 flick gesture. And I got used to that. A lot of people still hated it. What we've seen now is that you can no longer enter the you can no longer quickly switch between apps from the home screen. That just doesn't work anymore. You actually have to physically open the, open the button or open the multitasking menu and then swipe between apps, or you have to be inside another app to do so. And the actual gesture of getting between apps is, well, it's much more like the iPhone, right? You swipe, you're in an app, you swipe along the side of the pill, and there's this nice animated flourish and you get into the previous app. I guess when it's finished, it'll be a bit more intuitive, but a lot of people are saying Google's just copying the iPhone here, right?
Yeah. And it's also, that's the multi-page thing we're talking about where it's like, well, first of all, it's hidden, which is weird, but also you have that little home pill there, but then now you're asking people to just like swipe around and just in that dead space on the right. And it's not replicated on the left. Nothing happens on the left side, except for sometimes this, you know, vestigial back button just randomly shows up. And so it's almost like if you were going to do this, like you said, iPhone style, like swipe across the bottom to switch between apps, why is that not just the entire bottom area like the iPhone? You know, why are you doing this weird hybrid approach of the home button is always there, but now you don't gesture on the home button, you gesture to the right of it, and then there's a back button sometimes, and sometimes it's not.
This is completely unfinished. I mean,
yeah,
one of the things they touted about Android Pie was how easy it was to switch between your apps from any screen. And they've taken that away, or at least made it where now we have to learn a new way to do it. So they're not done here. This is just, you know, let's implement what we have so we can test it and guess who the lucky testers are.
Right. But but like, that's not my concern at all. I just want to be clear about that. I don't want people emailing me going, you know what you're getting yourself into. You downloaded a beta. That's not what I'm saying here.
Right.
I'm saying, what is their end goal here? Right. Because we don't even have, like, most of the OEMs out there have not implemented Google's gesture system directly, right? Actually, only Android One phones running Pi have emulated it to the T. By default, Samsung does not use the gesture system. And even if you enable their gestures, it's nothing like what Google's done. Same with Huawei. LG with the G8, I tested it during my hands-on. They have exactly Google's implementation, but it's not on by default. So you actually have to explicitly turn it on. As far as I know, no other company has implemented Google's Pixel gestures. So this is appealing to a very, very small number of users. And my question is, once Q is rolled out, it's inevitably going to be very different to P, but are they doing it because they want, they're like, okay, none of the OEMs implemented it because it's clunky. We should revamp it so that they will implement it. Or is this just meant to improve the Pixel?
I mean, I don't think it matters how good the gestures are. The other manufacturers are going to do what they want to do unless it's forced on them.
Right.
I think, obviously, it's a happy coincidence that Pi's gestures are not great and that then manufacturers also didn't use them and tried to do their own thing. But realistically, the main reason why they didn't use Pi's gestures is because they wanted to use their own and do their own thing. And Google didn't force them to take the gestures even as an option, which I kind of would have thought that it would have been forced to have it as an option. But, you know, that's not really Google's game to force companies to do that. But we ended up getting the worst version of that, which is every phone has a little bit of it. Like, the, you know, you mentioned Samsung not being like Pi at all, except for they did take the right swipe on the home button to switch between apps exactly like Pi does it. But then all the other gestures are different.
It's not at all. Like, I mean, it is technically, except the fact that it's not intuitive because you don't know it's there. I guarantee
which
everybody
is the
who's
problem with all the gestures.
Yeah, but at least with a pill, you can kind of, you can sort of assume that there's something there because the UX guides you a little bit. There's some animation with the Galaxy S10. Like, you have no idea that you can do that until you accidentally activate it.
Yeah. And you have the recents button anyway, so.
True. But then, like, the tuning on the Galaxy S10 is completely different. So you only have to gesture a tiny little bit, and then you go like four apps back and you're like, oh crap, I accelerated too quickly and now I have to reverse. So the tuning is just completely off.
So that's like, so that's the point, is by not putting its foot down one way or the other, Google just made it really easy for everyone to make all of their own mistakes. And now we have everybody with a different set of mistakes in navigation.
You have to understand, everything Google does with the user interface in Android is designed to make more apps more compatible with more phones in Google Play. That's Android itself is just a conduit so Google and other companies can make money. Yes, there is a Pixel division and they want to try to showcase their skills at building software. And I get that, but I want to pretend that that's a completely separate part of the company. Like, you know, put them on the side of the table with Samsung and LG, and then the engineers that build Android on the other side of the table. These gestures will be forced eventually. But before that happens, a way that keeps every app in Google Play compatible with every phone needs to be sorted out. The back button is a big stickler. And it's going to be 5 years before the apps in Google Play will work. You know, there are apps that have a back button built into the software. There are apps that need a back button and have no way to do it unless the manufacturer provides a way back in the user interface. It's going to be years before those apps are gone. And this is a hard thing to do. I don't want to sound like we're, you know, poking the bear or saying that Google's doing it wrong or whatever, because we don't know what their actual roadmap is. But I do know the end goal is so we can offer more consistency. Even though manufacturers do their own thing, it's still consistent with all the apps in the Play Store.
So that's what I mean, Jerry. This is, they're not enforcing this the way that they enforced,
no,
you know, things happening in the status bar. They want OEMs to have flexibility with navigation, but they always make these big sweeping changes as best practices.
Right.
Because every single manufacturer, with when they upgraded to Android Pie, did implement some sort of gesture navigation. Yep. Across the board. I mean, you look at OnePlus, which hews very closely to what Google did with Pie, but in fact did it better. But when they did their own gesture nav on when they updated to Oreo, I really liked that, except it was completely different from what we'd seen in the Android P beta. So when they finally upgraded the OnePlus 6 and 6T to Pi, they were like, okay, we're just going to follow Google. And I think that is what a lot of companies want. And I bet you there were a lot of internal discussions at Samsung as to whether they should just allow customers to navigate like they do on the Pixel with One UI. But they probably decided that there were no advantages to doing exactly what Google was doing, because it just wasn't intuitive. And I wonder, at what point will Google get to the point where its navigation is intuitive? Because they're never going back to 3-button. Never.
I look to multi-window when we talk about this kind of thing, because multi-window has been part of Android. I think Ice Cream Sandwich is when it first started to appear. And Google didn't do really anything with it, but Samsung did. Samsung took what was there, built on top of it, and made a multi-window system that worked really well as long as you use the right apps. Well, Google used a lot of that and built it into their own multi-window system, and now it's pretty good. In fact, what we see on Huawei and Samsung with like a sort of a desktop mode, that's the continuation of multi-window, and it's been in Android since version 6 if you knew how to dig in and start the activities. And Google does that a lot. They give a base that, look, this will work. And then they let companies like Samsung run with it. And they take the great ideas that Samsung had and build it back into their base and make something that a customer can use and then fine-tune it.
And I think the only problem with that, though, is that when you're talking about something so fundamental to the phone as the core navigation paradigm of how Android phones work, that's extra frustrating rather than something like multi-window, which is not fundamental to the user interface.
But let's go back to how Samsung does it in One UI. I think generally everybody likes that. And that gives Google a whole bunch of, you know, clues on what they need to do to improve, you know, gesture navigation in Android itself. That puts,
puts the
Pixel division at a real disadvantage. But, you know, that's for them to solve. They're a completely separate part of the company. I'm sure they work together very closely, but they are a separate part of the company. And if they wanted to solve this a different way, I'm pretty sure they could.
The gesture system is inevitably going to be tweaked between now and the last beta. There are going to be 6 beta versions within Android Q. We're now on 2. We know, based on Google's own timeline, that beta 3 will be launched at Google I.O. on May 7th. The interesting part is that last year, the beta that launched at I.O. was actually the first official beta. The previous 2 releases were called developer previews. And when Google debuted beta 1 of Android P, that's when we saw the gesture navigation debut. So yeah. My guess is that we will see a much more fully formed version of what they intend in a month from now.
Probably.
Let's move on to a couple of other introductions within beta 2. So the two that I want to talk about, one's developer focused, which will affect users. It's called scoped storage.
Yeah.
And the other is notification bubbles. Let's talk about notification bubbles first. I'm curious as to why Google wants to build a framework that essentially gives apps like Hangouts and Slack and anything else that sends notifications access to an overlay for notifications when we already know as users that chat heads are the worst, nobody should ever use them, and that Correct. I want them to die.
I can answer that because we know that chat heads are the worst and nobody wants to use them and they need to die. So Google says, what can we do to fix that?
I don't follow.
They Google's, what can we do to make an idea like chat heads something that people love? Right.
We recognize that people want this kind of thing. We think it's horrible. Can we build a native version of it to make it better?
Yeah, and I like what they are doing with that. They're just providing a framework. You can't go into the settings in beta 2 and make this happen. You have to build an app that actually uses what's there. And I kind of like that because, yeah, that's going to lead to some really crappy apps that do horrible things on your screen that you absolutely hate. But it also gives Samsung and Huawei something to run with.
Okay, so how do you see notification bubbles implemented in the final version of Android Q?
I think that it's probably going to be something that the Gmail app or other native Google apps can use. And other than that, you won't ever see them until application developers decide they want to include them. It's not going to be a thing on your phone unless an app wants to use it. And I'm sure it's going to be optional at first because it's very polarizing. I hate them. I absolutely hate the entire idea. Daniel shared a video with me. A fellow built an app that does nothing but call up all these functions of the way, let's call them chat bubbles. I don't know what you want to call them. But it just looks horrible to me. It makes me shudder. I never in my life want to see any sort of notification that does that to my screen. But I understand a lot of people do. And you throw it out there and let some really bright minds make it a whole lot better than the crappy way we've seen it done now is probably the right way to do that.
Okay, so here is what we know about bubbles directly from the Android Q developer notes. Bubbles are a multitasking feature that allow an overlay of existing notifications on the Android system. They float on top of other app content and follow the user wherever they go. They can then be expanded to reveal app functionality and information and then collapse when not in use. So two things here. They use the existing notification API.
Right.
We currently have the ability to expand notifications for things like quick replies or even smart replies. And this just expands on that by
it looks just like that.
Building a small version of that app, say your SMS app. You can then not just reply to a person from the notification shape, but actually see the conversation, similar to chat heads if you've ever used it. The one thing that troubles me here is this. Bubbles are an opt-out feature. When an app presents its first bubble, a permission dialog is shown that offers two choices. Block all bubbles from the app. Notifications are not blocked, but they will never appear as bubbles. Or allow all bubbles from your app. All notifications sent with the bubble metadata will appear as bubbles.
Yeah.
That is not great if it's an opt-out feature.
Yeah, and having it... I don't know. Yes, it's extra annoying because it's something that's, like you said, an overlay. But that's exactly how notifications work today. You get notifications from an app, and then you can swipe on it and adjust its notification settings to turn it off.
Right.
So from that standpoint, it's understandable that that's what they're doing.
So here's the thing. I'm playing Candy Crush. I'm intensely, you know, trying to figure out a level. I'm really into it. All of a sudden, I get an SMS. The bubble gets put in the center of my screen with a little one or however many notifications I get. I feel like that's way more distracting then a little dialogue at the top of my screen that disappears within a couple of seconds. And if I opt into that, that's not a great experience. But again, I'm not dismissing it because it's not finished and we don't know how it's going to work in real life. But that's my concern, is that developers are going to take advantage of it and may abuse it.
But it's extremely counterintuitive, actually. I agree with you here that it's very counterintuitive to the fact that one of Android's biggest strengths is its notification management. And the fact that that notification bar is extremely powerful and the ability to triage, manage, respond to messages directly from, you know, and perform actions on data inside of apps through the notification center is, you know, that's extremely important. So I agree. It is really difficult to see how this is an improvement or at all augments that to make it better.
Well, my biggest fear, and I'll use the word fear here, is it's more than just a chat head bubble. There is, you're going to be able to actually, the demo app that was in the video that Daniel shared, and I'll make sure the link to this video gets put in the notes for this podcast. They're actually bringing up Chrome and other apps inside this little notification bubble. That is the potential for so much garbage that I never, ever want to see.
Absolutely. But there is one upside to this, which is to Jerry's original point about it being kind of a better version of Chatheads, is that it groups all of the ongoing apps that you're using in those bubbles together. And so it's one group of them rather than a group of conversations inside of one app. So you would never have a bunch of different groups of bubbles all separately. You have one grouping, and then when you tap it, you can toggle between like Hangouts and Android Messages and Slack all at the same time in the same interface. So it's at least standardized, but I agree, it's going to turn into a catch-all pretty quickly, because that's one of the biggest things of why Chatheads exists in the first place, is that they want to dominate your home screen and they want to be on top of every single app when you switch apps. The whole point was making it so in your face that you will think about Facebook Messenger all the time. And this is like the next level of having permission to go to notifications. You have getting user permission, or I guess not having them opt out, is just the next frontier of making sure that people pay attention to your app.
Is this the first step of doing away with the status bar? I hope not,
but I agree. It's very duplicative with a lot of what the notification center does.
So what's interesting here is our friend Chris Lacey, who developed Action Launcher and Link Bubble and a lot of other really great apps, called out the fact that Google is deprecating an old API that allowed apps like Link Bubble to function. And they said this in the first beta, where they said, okay, as of Q, you will not be able to just indiscriminately create overlays like you did
with
Link
Bubble.
Which
is a major security concern.
Exactly. But there was no indication as to why they were deprecating it now. Now we know why. Yeah. So they're deprecating that old insecure API because apps like Link Bubble, which basically give you a fully featured Chromium or web view where you can just like put it anywhere, that's no longer something Google wants developers to be able to do. It's a little bit too powerful and it's not sandboxed well enough. They said, okay, instead of just allowing any kind of app to create a bubble, we're only going to limit it to notifications and we're going to pair it specifically with the existing notification API so it doesn't break when developers create bubbles and you're using an older version of Android. It'll just come through as a regular notification. That makes a lot of sense.
And that's great. You know, I hope Chris Lacey runs with this and rebuilds, you know, something like Link Bubble using this new bubble API.
But will he even be able to? Because it's something, you know, it's only associated with notifications now. So you send a notification, hey, I want to create an instance of X app, and then you say, okay, that's fine. But you can't launch an app with this API separate from a notification.
Look at Slack as an example, on the desktop. Notifications and inline, text in Slack includes web link previews and video previews and, photo previews. We know notifications can already provide photo previews in P. Nobody bothered to do anything with it, but it was there. Imagine that in a bigger resizable bubble in the middle of your screen. Somebody like Chris Lacy can build an application that, hey, check out this cool thing I found on YouTube, and I send that to Andrew through Hangouts. He can tap the bubble, and there's the little video playing inside that bubble, or a preview to the web page, or, it fetches Amazon's metadata and shows what I think he should buy inside the bubble itself. A talented developer that wants to do something really great can make something really great with that. Unfortunately, somebody, let's say I had a lot of free time on my hands and wanted to mess with everybody, I could make a really horrible app that takes over your screen with some sort of garbage because I can. That's my biggest fear, is how much garbage is going to be out there that we have to wade through to find the Chris Lacy's out there that do something good with it.
Okay, so we know that Android Q is also going to officially support foldables. I am making a leap here, but with the proliferation of foldable phones like the Galaxy Fold and the Huawei Mate X, is it possible that Google is just going to use this as a way to take advantage of the additional screen real estate afforded by foldables, right? So you have a much larger horizontal or like one-to-one aspect ratio tablet screen when you open the phone. You have a lot more room to kind of store stuff in the corners and forget about it because you can use things in Windows. Is that something that Google is thinking about, or are bubbles going to be used sort of for a completely different purpose?
They seem to be better positioned for smaller screens than larger ones, and you would hope that the only connection would really be just thinking about how apps rescale when they're put into much smaller windows. I mean, you could see what's going on with these bubbles is you're getting a subset of information in this little window that's like a quarter of the size of your screen, and you could see how that knowledge of how the apps would reflow and having developers think about those sizes would make sense when you're doing kind of the three windows at a time type thing on a foldable. But it doesn't seem like the bubble system itself necessarily translates well to the
foldables. See where Daniel's going with this, and it scares the hell out of me. Because, yeah, this could be Google's way of, okay, so you've got an app that looks really, really poor if you stretch it out full width of your foldable device. Well, you don't have to stretch it out. And you've got all that free space over here. Hey, check this out. You can put this there.
Right. I mean, it's just a way, like, we know that you'll be able to resize windows using Freeform with, with the Fold and Mate X. But you're not going to want apps to take up your whole screen most of the time. So why don't you just reserve the apps that you need for these bubbles, like your SMS app or Slack or whatever, where you often receive notifications. And because you have a much wider surface area to work with, these incoming bubbles are not necessarily going to get in your way. I don't know. I mean, it's that to me, that's the thing that makes the most sense about this. But at the same time, so few people are going to be using foldable phones with Android Q that maybe that's not the intended use case. Who knows?
But I like the way you think. I don't like the fact that makes this, the status bar completely obsolete, because I think that's my favorite part of Android is the notification shade. But the way you're thinking, that to me sounds like the way a developer and user interface designer would think. I'm following you and I'm feeling you, and I think you're onto something there.
Okay, so let's talk about the last big change to Android Q Beta 2. That's something called scoped storage, and this is what broke so many apps in the second beta. Jerry, talk about what this is and why it's a big deal.
Okay, scoped storage is going to, if I write an app, I can write to and from the SD card in my own little sandbox at will. I don't need any permissions to do anything. That's mine. I can do whatever I want with it. But I need new permissions to do anything like touch the photos or read external storage for anything else. Everything but the downloads folder I can no longer get to without having the correct permissions. It's a security thing. It's done so the user doesn't have to accept permissions because nobody reads what they're accepting, and it's a good way to abuse the system. If I ask you for a whole bunch of permissions I don't need because I know you'll say yes, this does away with me asking for those permissions to read and write anything. And if I write an app that needs access to, let's say, your folder full of photos, it will only ask the first time I go to fetch a photo, and then it's done. It never has to ask anything again. Yet it still keeps me away from other private data. I get where Google's going with this. The reason it broke everything is because it's a whole new set of permissions that none of these apps are asking for.
Right. So the question is, how is this different from the behavior of current sandboxes? So right now, for example, an app doesn't necessarily, if I have a gallery app, it asks for my permission to view my photos. It then, if I accept, gets access to my gallery, which is a set of folders within my internal storage. How is scoped storage going to treat that type of interaction differently?
If your gallery app will no longer need any permissions unless you want to look at another application's files, like your camera roll. You know, your camera roll, your photos, that is an application. Now it's part of Google Photos. That's storage on your device that Google Photos is allowed to use, you know, freely under scope storage. That's Google Photos sandbox. Your gallery can't get to that without asking permission, and that's like it is now. But for your gallery app to use its own storage, let's say you want to save a file to your new gallery, or you want to make a collection in your new gallery, no permissions are necessary. That's really the only user-facing change, is it's going to ask you for less permission so you don't have to click through all those dialog boxes. Hopefully that means you'll pay attention to the fewer ones that you need to see.
Got it.
Under the hood, there's got to be more here. Android Q also introduces media scoped applications. And that's, now we know why. Part of it was for the thing with the EU, where it lets users pick their own web browser, let's say, more easily. So now you can set an application as a default in a new way with a new interface that's easier. I'm guessing these two are going to be tied together somehow. They're both using the word scope, and that means that they're, when you get into the code, you ask for permissions. It's this big long string of code with periods in it. It'll use the word scoped, and two things that use scoped will be lumped together. I don't know exactly where Google's going with this, but it's going to tie in somehow. If I write a media player that can play videos and music, I'll have my own space that I can use. And it's also going to be tied in to make it easier for me to become the default player. That part hasn't been revealed just yet.
Got it. Okay. So that sounds a bit complicated, but mainly this is aimed at improving the relationship between the end user and the permissions that often the end user doesn't quite read or doesn't understand that they're accepting.
Right. It is. This is a security feature. That's what it is. And they've done it in a way to make it easier for you because there's less you have to decide.
Right.
A lot of people don't like that. They want complete control, but you know,
that's what they say. But realistically, if this is working properly, they don't have to think about it at all. And that's the best way to go.
Right. There's no need for me to say you're allowed to do something because it can only do that thing. And if I don't like that, I won't install the app.
All right, moving along, there's two more features that were discovered just today, actually, as we're recording this. Within Beta 2, they are not public yet. Google hasn't acknowledged them, but they're interesting anyway, and they may be revealed in future betas. So the first is something called a Pixel Themes app. This is something that Google has been moving towards in previous versions. We could change accent colors in the first beta, and now there's an APK tucked away. It's empty in beta 2, but there are some assets inside the APK that show us what Google could be working on, which could be basically a theme picker, similar to what you find on Samsung phones and LG phones. This one's a little bit more tasteful, mind you.
A little bit more in the vein of what OnePlus does.
Exactly. That OnePlus is a really good example of a
accent colors, you know, to be green now or something like that.
Right. And there seems to be some like icon changes in the quick settings bar and things like that. But do you think that this is something that Google is going to actually roll out in future Pixels?
This is part of the Pixel launcher. This isn't part of Android. I'm 99% certain. This is a way for me to choose the accent color, and you know, you can already choose between teardrops or round or square. You know, at least you could. I haven't checked. Maybe on beta 2 you can't. But this is a way to let me choose what the checkboxes look like and what the highlight color looks like. And it's part of the Pixel launcher. I'm certain this isn't actually going to be tied in to Android. It's just coming with along with the update to Q for the Pixel launcher.
Okay, so you're differentiating them between the Pixel launch. I mean, this will, like, the Pixel launcher is exclusive to the Pixel,
right?
So that really doesn't matter. But like, when you say it'll work with the Pixel launcher, this still looks like it'll be a system-wide color change to the quick settings and all,
right?
And that.
I didn't mean just the launcher itself. I meant it's going to be
the Pixel interface, right, rather than the Android Q system.
You have a Pixel system.
Yeah, I should have clarified that.
Right.
It's really, you know, it's no different than what Samsung and OnePlus are already doing. Like you said, maybe it's a little more tasteful, but it's
kind of like the gestures. Like there's Android Pie technically has these gestures, but they only show up in some phones. There are some things that are across the board, and then there are some things that are very Pixel specific.
Right. Yeah. People that use the Pixel and use this, you know, the standard interface, they don't go to XDA and install one UI on their Pixel or something crazy like that. This is a way for them to make their phone a little more personalized and a little less white.
Which, I mean, Google has been moving towards with Android for years.
Right.
So this is just giving you a bit more choice. That's great. The second thing is something that may not be anything. It could be a nothing burger, but it's interesting nonetheless. There's a new motion event documentation within Android Q Beta 2 that allows for, quote, deep pressing, which is similar to Touch ID or Force Touch or whatever it's called, 3D Touch on the iPhone.
Which has been such a rousing success in iOS.
I don't know. That's you've been able to detect a harder press since Gingerbread.
Yeah, exactly. So why is this new?
I don't understand. This has got to be a new way to do it, or it wouldn't have new APIs.
Also, I don't understand how this is going to at all be standardized across the wide range of hardware that Android runs on. It just seems like a complete disaster.
From what I understand, and I don't know this, this is what somebody else told me, the way it works is because when you press harder, more of your finger is pressing mm-hmm. against the screen. It's a wider press. So the capacitive layer in the touchscreen can detect that you're pressing harder because it's a wider area. And if so, I mean, it should work on every phone with a capacitive screen. Should. I'll say should one more time.
But again, this has been the case for years. Like, you've been able to do that. It just hasn't had like a low-level API that would allow for it system-wide.
One of the versions of Chrome did something with it when they introduced the deal where your home screen icon, you could press it, hold it, long press, and you got different choices and different options.
Mm-hmm.
One of the versions of Chrome did something where you could long press and then long press harder, and you got something else. I don't remember what it was because it went away so quickly with the next version. I have no clue what this is thrown into Android for as part of Android itself, unless it has something to do with in-screen fingerprint readers.
Hmm.
Which have also just been a massive success. It's really weird because Google has, like you said, Jerry, Google has done a whole bunch of weird stuff off and on with long presses and hasn't really done a fantastic job implementing those. So you just just seems like another thing that's showing up, and you know, we don't see what's going on behind the scenes and why.
There's got to be something that can be figured out that can make great user interfaces based on how you tap your phone. I know it, and I'm nobody important, but more importantly, Apple and Google know it. That's why they're trying things like, you know, you long press to get a different set of actions, or with Apple, they have a sensor that reads how hard you touch, and it gives you more options to choose. There's something that we'll eventually get to that makes for great UX based on how we touch our phone. I'm glad to see that Google and Apple are working hard to figure out what it is. I just hope to God they find it soon, because it's especially as an Android user, it's just a mess. But you move between phone to phone and app to app, it's not consistent at all, and it makes me not want to do it. I just tap an icon.
And actually, something that Daniel mentioned earlier kind of comes back to mind here with large screen / foldable devices, where, and just in general with the way that Android phones are going, getting bigger and bigger and taller and taller, it's so much harder and is going to continue to get more difficult to reach all of the screen with your hand. And so you have to go, you know, rather than going, you know, up and down in two-dimensional space for more UX and UI, you have to go three-dimensional. You have to go in the Z-axis to try to add more things. And, you know, the companies have recognized this for a long time, doing lots of different gestures and long presses and all that kind of stuff to try to make more things accessible to where you are. But that's going to become even more important when your phone is folding out into a 4x3 screen that's like 7 inches across.
Maybe if you press really hard on the part of the screen you're not using, but you can reach, a chat head will appear.
Or you're going to get grossed out because you're going to press in and feel that plastic screen flex under your thumb.
But isn't Samsung introduced a pressure sensitive home button in the Galaxy S8
mercilessly
and 9.
Killed it.
Yeah, and then just got rid of it this year, which I actually find to be quite frustrating.
But that was a perfect example of, like, we have this pressure sensitivity thing and we're going to make it, you know, easy to wean people off of using a home button on the Galaxy S7, and then it didn't matter and they didn't do anything with it.
Yeah, exactly, but it was just a good feature.
Yep.
Period. So, I mean, of all, like, Samsung has held on to things like Smart Stay for like 7 years.
And like pop-out windows and edge screen, but then they killed the thing that actually let you turn on your phone with a hard press.
And that's a really good point. So the pop-up window in One UI is a feature that it's off by default, but like that's basically a very, very clunky version of the chat bubble.
And it's also something that's tied into their popover notifications that some apps can offer.
Sure.
Because you can just tap a popover and get a pop-out window. It just looks like, you know, it belongs in Windows Vista.
Oh my God. That's just brutal.
But it's so true. It's trudel.
All right. Let's
one more thing with Q that Daniel, I know you'll love. You'll understand.
Okay, hit me.
Zoomable directional microphone API. You know, your phone has three microphones and they use it for noise canceling while you're on a call. But now the example that the developer page gives is if you're taking a video selfie, you can have the front facing microphone zoom where the camera is being focused and you'll have better audio while you're taking your front facing video selfie.
So what's really interesting about that is the Pixel 3 has arguably the worst audio capture of any phone that I've ever used, including the Pixel 2.
Which was already a dumpster fire
on its own. So I find this to be really interesting that like the Google or the Android engineering side is like, hey, Pixel team, we're going to make your life a little bit easier here because somehow you keep screwing this up.
I just think it's great. I mean, we all have taken video with our phone and had a great video and we wished that the sound was a little better. And this is going to make that sound better, and that's cool. Make the things we like better, and no chat heads.
Well, chat heads will happen apparently whether we like it or not.
Yep.
All right, so let's move on to the last topic because I want to talk about this for 5 minutes. Verizon launched its 5G network this week in two cities, not even in two cities in.
Parts.
Very select parts of two cities, Chicago and Minnesota. Minneapolis, Minnesota. And the Chicago one makes sense because Motorola's headquarters are there, and they basically developed this first run with Motorola because the only device that currently supports Verizon's 5G network from a mobile perspective is the Moto Z3 with the 5G Moto mod. We are going to Chicago next week to test this, but some sites have already done this earlier. And our friends at Tom's Guide and Engadget and CNET have all seen speeds upwards of 600 megabits a second. These are actual download speeds.
Yeah.
But you have to be super close to the millimeter wave base station to receive those speeds. And it seems to be fluctuating really, really significantly. Like within like a couple of feet, you'll lose the connection. So, Jerry, what's happening with this? And is this a foreboding of things to come? Or is this just a V1 that's not really doing very well?
A little of column A and a little of column B. Verizon was very upfront saying that there's plenty of room to grow. This is the first version and this is... We want to get it out there, and it will improve drastically over time. So they preface this all with, hey, guys, this isn't going to be great, but it will be the next time, we promise. But this is also just how the way Verizon is deploying 5G, which is actually the quote-unquote right way, according to the people that developed the technology. This is how it works. It's no longer... great big cell towers that as long as you're within 15 miles of, you get good service. These are tiny little cell towers that you have to be close, and they're no longer towers. They're the size of a shoebox.
And this will continue to be the reality for an extremely long time because those base stations are not going to get better at providing you... Like that individual base station is not going to get better at providing you a good signal between, you know, like you said, moving 3 feet across. It's that you're going to move 3 feet and you're going to be on a different base station. You're not going to be on that original one. So that's kind of the whole point. And that's what's going to still, I mean, it still creates the same problem regardless, well, you know, in the interim.
The individual base stations can, the amplitude can be bumped up a little bit. There is room for improvement, but not drastic improvement. You have to be close to one of these new installations.
Well, I think what I'm saying is that they're designed to have a very narrow range.
With a lot of overlap.
And a narrow.
Right.
Exactly.
Like Aero mesh Wi-Fi systems. They're pinpoint. They pinpoint good service where it needs to be. And the way the backhaul works and the way that these, I'll call them nodes, because to me now I think of them as nodes. They can put a node where they need it to be and have it pull out of the backhaul cheaply. So that's good. What's not so good is you're going to need these nodes every maybe 100, 150 feet, just daisy chained everywhere to blanket a city with 5G service. Chicago, can you imagine how expensive it's going to be for Verizon to blanket Chicago with 5G when that means that every little station has to be within 100 feet of another station? That's insane.
Yeah, it seems like an absurd logistical problem.
Well, I know how they're trying to solve it, and I think they're on the right track. I have an office building. Well, let us put, 150 little installations in your office building. Oh, I don't have room for all that. And then they pull out something that's the size of a shoebox, and it only draws a watt and a half of power. Boom, I say, sure, that gives my employees better cell coverage. Do it. They're going to get them. They're no longer going to have to fight to install these big, huge towers everywhere. And I think they're going to be able to get these wherever they need them. It's just finding a financial incentive to put them out there.
So here's the thing. Where you do find a 5G signal, the speeds are demonstrably faster than even the fastest LTE networks in the US right now. So, if you're in a perfect, relatively low load area running a Galaxy S10 with 4x4 MIMO with, four times carrier aggregation or five times carrier aggregation, you can get to speeds of, a gigabit. Like, technically, it is possible. The baseband inside the phone, the Snapdragon version at least, supports 2 gigabit speeds, technically, but that's with 7 times carrier aggregation, and no carrier in the world supports that yet. But realistically, you can get to speeds about a gigabit. Nobody is getting speeds of a gigabit, not even here in Canada, where the networks are much more optimized. I mean, we have insane speeds pretty much everywhere I go. And we pay out the butt for it because our networks are basically monopolies, but that's a whole other argument. Or oligopolies, because there's two. But just this morning I did a speed test on my Huawei P30 Pro and I got 205 megabits a second down and like 50 megabits up. These are really good speeds. But when you switch over to 5G, you're getting 450, 500, 600 megabits, no problem. The problem here is that you're going to go back to LTE quite a lot.
Yep.
And Verizon is defending itself by saying, well, we have an amazing LTE network anyway. Like, we have the best coverage in the US. Why does it matter that for the 10 people using 5G right now, you may not be on it all the time? So that is really, it's not excusing the fact that this is a really rocky rollout, but it's still very early on and it'll only get better, right?
I think so. I'm going to admit it. Verizon impressed me. They waited. They didn't release something half-baked and call it 5G. They played around with, some home service and tinkered and switched the switches around and did what they needed to do. And then when they debuted something, it worked. It may not be perfect, and they told us in advance it's not perfect yet. And there are inherent problems with the technology that, there are logistical problems that need to be solved. But the first demo they threw out there did exactly what the papers about it say it should have done. That's impressive. Now, to further impress me, they need to show me in 2021 have the entire city of Chicago blanketed with 5G so people with a Galaxy S12 don't ever switch back to your 700 megahertz LTE. And then I'll say you did it.
So the problem with that is that there are two types of 5G systems, right? There's NSA, which is non-standalone, and then there's SA, which is standalone. And even by 2021, it's not evident that any 5G networks in the world will be SA just yet. And that means that for anything, like 90% of what you'll use your phone for will still depend on LTE. That includes voice, that includes the majority of uplink, and even most of your downlink data. The way that 5G has been built is that when a packet opens up or a downlink opportunity, for lack of a better word, opens up that's large enough, like if you're downloading a video or streaming something from Netflix, a 5G will determine whether it needs to kick in. It's dynamic, but it's also intelligent. It says we're not going to use this massive.
How seamless is that? Is the question?
Right. I don't. Oh, it is seamless. It has to be. It's built into the spec.
Right.
But is that the right way to do it? The carriers think so because it's cost effective. But when you're buying into a 5G plan for an extra $10 a month, but you're only accessing 5G. For like 5% of your network, is that really what you're getting?
It's the right way to do it right now, because if you didn't do it that way, and I bought a 5G plan from Verizon and had a 5G phone, it would only work if I was sitting in the right coffee shop in downtown Chicago. Anywhere else, I wouldn't have any type of service. I get why the carriers like this, and you hit it right on the head, cost effectiveness. This saves them a ton of money and gives them an infinite amount of time to roll out a good 5G network, but yet they can claim they have a 5G network because they do have it in certain spots when your phone can use it and says it needs to use it. As a tech enthusiast, no, man, throw that garbage away. Make these carriers spend that money. Give me 5G the way I think 5G should work as a standalone system. And 600 megabits download speed everywhere in the world. But I know it'll never happen. But I can dream.
It'll get there.
Yes. You know, this, think of Seoul, the city of Seoul, or Tokyo. They don't have these logistical problems. They don't have, you know, I know there's more than one telecom company in South Korea, but they will all work together and they will have this deployed. I imagine, you know, like a giant nest of worker ants will swarm the city, and just overnight this will all work, and you'll have 400 megabit download speeds everywhere in Seoul if you need them.
I think you already do, because their LTE networks are so damn good.
Yeah, you're right, you do. So you'll have gigabit download speeds in Seoul.
And you have it, you know, underground and you know, inside every single inch of every building.
That was my favorite part of being in Seoul, was that you just never lost signal. Ever. It doesn't matter where you were, how far underground you were. You just always had it.
The flip side of that is the little community right down the road where I live. They have really horrible 2G cell phone service. They're fighting. They're suing AT&T because AT&T got the rights to put up a cell tower. We don't want to see your ugly cell tower. So the places like that will never have good broadband internet. They don't deserve it, in my opinion. You hear that?
Well, it's also,
none of you all deserve it.
The difference is that, you know, South Korea and Japan are like physically the size of, like, I'm going to get this wrong, but maybe like California or Texas, right? It's like,
More like Washington State.
They're
fair. I don't know the exact geography, but I mean, they're tiny in comparison. So it's expensive to roll out.
They don't have the huge government regulation and overhead that makes it hard for companies to do things. The government works with the companies.
Well, I mean, to be fair though, like, the government is owned by the
companies. I know, I wasn't going to go that far, there's nothing to stop telecom companies and phone manufacturers from giving the people in South Korea this. Whereas here in the States, especially, and to a lesser extent in Canada, there's hurdles?
Well, there are no hurdles to us talking about this for hours and hours and hours. But unfortunately, we have to end there. So we will have lots more to talk about with 5G, because three other carriers have to launch the damn thing. Well, two, because
soon, two.
Inevitably, T-Mobile and Sprint will merge, and everything will be terrible.
T-Mobile's on record saying they're not even going to do anything until the second half of this year.
And they in their appeal to the FCC, they also said that they can't roll out 5G in the way they want to without Sprint. So whether that's true or not is up to the regulator. But that, again, that's another podcast for another time. Jerry, Andrew, thank you so much. You are wonderful.
Thank you, wow. Daniel. You're okay, wonderful.
Okay, appreciate too. That. And to just talk about 5G, it's no big deal.
And thank you for listening, everybody. If you have any feedback on the show, send it to us at podcast@Android Central. We love hearing from you. Have a great weekend. And thanks for listening. We will talk to you again very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Adios.